Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. As the economic collapse associated with the coronavirus enters its second month, it was my distinct pleasure to have Howard Marks, the founder of Oaktree Capital, on the Alpha Exchange. A highly successful investor across many decades, Howard has managed risk through a vast number of market cycles. His assessment of the complex mix of economic, financial, and monetary aspects of the coronavirus crisis provides context for factors at work in market prices. A buyer of quickly cheapening assets in the middle 2 weeks of March, Howard sees a less compelling case on the long side now, given the severity of the shock and the challenges to be faced in returning to a full-speed economy. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Howard Marks. On the Alpha Exchange today, my guest is Howard Marks. He's the founder of Oaktree Capital and a man who needs no introduction. Howard, thanks so much for taking the time to share your valuable insights with us today.
Pleasure to be here, Dean.
So we are in the midst of, obviously, a really unique and challenging time for the country, for markets, for policymakers. It's the day of an unemployment report we couldn't have imagined even a couple of months ago. I think the number of job losses was actually better than the consensus by 1.5 million jobs, which is just so far out of bounds. So we've got this gigantic sudden stop, obviously a tremendous loss of profits for corporate America, and then this huge response from both the government and the Federal Reserve. I'm just wondering, as we get our conversation started, if you can frame for us, for you and for your team at Oaktree, as you kind of size all of these things up, what is most top of mind for you as you look around the world in terms of economies and asset prices and policy?
I've just put the finishing touches on a memo, which will be out soon, which means it will predate your podcast, on the subject of uncertainty. I think it's extremely important for people to realize how little we know about the future. If you think about it, there are four things going on today: the disease, the economic response, the oil crash, and the Fed/government response. Each of those things is complicated, unprecedented, and unpredictable. So you have four unpredictable, massive influences at the same time, and certainly their interactions are unpredictable. So my basic point is that we have no idea what the future holds. We only know anything about the future by extrapolating from the past. But when we have no history which is relevant or comparable, we have no ability to extrapolate. So I put it simply, if you have never experienced something before, you can't say you know how it's going to end. And I think that's very important. Obviously, there are big conflicts going on today, big interactions. Number one, we're going to try to reopen the economy, but we have no idea what that will do to the future of the disease. Number two, the economy has contracted incredibly, as you described. We really don't know if the Fed and government actions are going to be sufficient to offset that. And we don't know what their long-term effects are going to be. So, unfortunately, I think that the main thing to bear in mind is that the future is unusually murky. I'm not somebody who believes in forecasts. I believe in thinking about the distribution of future possibilities. And we can only think about the future in terms of a probability distribution. And today, the distribution is unusually wide. A worrier like me thinks that there are unusual possibilities to the downside. I don't see great things to the upside. I don't see this as being a bonanza for the country or the world, but the range of possibilities on the downside is unusually wide and, again, unpredictable.
One of the things that you just said was just around assessing the kind of future probabilistic outcomes and trying to not forecast, but have an understanding as to where things might go. And what we seem to see at each turn with episodes of crisis is the degree to which the government and the Fed play a role in trying to revive the patient to a large extent, that role gets increasingly prominent. And certainly in this case, and probably for good reason, both the speed and scope of the policy response has been enormous, and it's actually even made the financial crisis seem modest. In terms of assessing the future probabilities, is handicapping the policy response, does that necessarily become a big and kind of newer part of the overall calculus for a firm like yours?
Well, I think it very much does. When we think about the future, as Mark Lipsitch of Harvard said about the disease, we have facts, inferences from analogies to the past, and what I call guesses. When we think about the future, economically speaking, financially speaking, number one, there are no facts. There are no facts about the future. Number two, there are inferences from the past, but as I said, there are no historical precedents. So really all we have are estimates or guesses. That's number one. We have never had a precedent for what's going on today. We've had slowdowns. I would say internal slowdowns. That is to say, the pace of the economy became unsustainably strong, from which there was a relapse. This time, what we have is a self-imposed shutdown of the economy. I think the best way to think about it is that sometimes in the hospital, if somebody's very sick, they put them into a coma so that the body can heal itself. And of course, while they're in the coma, they need life support to take over and support the body functions. And that's what we have going on today. In order to stop the spread of the disease, we shut down the economy so that people could shelter at home. While the economy was shut down, we can't let everybody starve to death. We can't let every business close. So the Fed and government are providing life support in the form of loans, grants, stimulus, and bond buying. So this is an action that is totally unprecedented. That's number one. Number two, over time, I think I would say over the last 25 years, starting with Alan Greenspan, I would say that the Fed in particular has become much more activist in trying to prevent recessions and respond and prevent market declines. And in a way, each episode of activism has perhaps accomplished its objective, but at the same time increased the dependence of the economy on more of the same. So now we're in a position where, because of the combination of those two reasons, the economy is unusually dependent on the actions of the government of the Fed, and we'll see the adequacy of those things to offset the decline of the economy. I've said in memos that in theory, the combination of the Fed and the government can simulate the financial operation of the economy. That is to say, they could send a check to every unemployed worker to replace his past earnings, his lost earnings, and they could send a check to every business owner to replace the lost profits. So everybody would be exactly in the same position, money-wise, that they would have been if the economy had continued. But the problem with that is GDP is goods and services. So what do we do without the goods and services? And if we go into that condition of simulating the operation of the economy, which is almost where we are today, what's required for it to resume its operation and resume producing goods and services? And these questions are huge and not easily answered in the absence of historical precedent.
I wanted to just go back a little bit, and you've obviously been a prominent investor for decades now. I was listening to one of your interviews, and you'd noted that Oaktree was founded, I believe it was April 15th of 95. So happy 25th year anniversary. I was also looking at the 10-year yield on that day, which was 6.66%. And today it's 63 basis points. The 2-year yield is 12 basis points. As you look back on all of these cycles, and you do a wonderful job for people trying to learn about the industry of really stepping back and helping people contextualize this notion of the cycle, but you certainly come back to a common playbook of maybe not boom and bust, but overbuilding that ultimately leads to excess and that ultimately causes a sell-off that leads to cheap asset prices and create another investable cycle. You've been through a lot of these. The telco bust, previous eras, probably the early 90s with real estate. When you look at this particular scenario, what strikes you as most different from all of these other cycles? Is this the most unique period that you've found yourself investing through?
Well, Mark Twain said that history does not repeat, but it does rhyme. And people always ask me, which past cycle is this one most like? And every cycle is different in its causes, in its effects, in its duration, in its amplitude, and so forth. But the main cycles that I've lived through in the past, I came into the business in 68, and from 68 until 82, we had a cycle marked by stagflation. Then we had a pretty much practically a straight up move from the early 80s to the late 90s. Then we had the Asia crisis, the bust of the TMT, tech, media, and telecom, and then the great global financial crisis in 08. And they were all caused by different things, some of them exogenous, but they were all cycles, as you say, the way I put it in my book, of excess and correction. This is not a typical cycle. And in fact, what's going on now is not really cyclical at all. This is just an exogenous shock. And this is not a correction which is caused by an excess. There may have been excesses and they may have set the stage for a correction, but this is caused by the disease and the need to close the economy to respond to it. So, as you note, in the past cycles, we've always been eager to invest at the low. We've put a lot of money to work on the way to the low and at the low and on the way coming back. And those purchases turned out to be pretty well timed, always predicated on the assumption that there would be a return to prosperity. Now we are in something unusual. I continue to believe that we will return to what we call prosperity. I don't think it'll necessarily feel as prosperous as it did in the past, but I think we'll come back. But we may come back gradually, haltingly, and we may come back differently. Prosperity in the future may be different in terms of group activities and which industries do well and which do poorly and so forth. And the return to what we'll call prosperity may take a long time. So that's different from in the past, but I think we have no alternative but to assume that we will have a recovery, but we should not assume that it'll be like those of the past. Everybody asks me two questions nowadays. Number one, which of the past crises you've lived through is this one most like? And number two, will the recovery be a V, a W, a U, an L? Somebody says a Nike swoosh. What will be the shape? And the answer to the latter is primarily that we don't know. But I think there'll be a recovery, and that's about all I know.
As we review the wreckage and certainly that incredibly, incredibly volatile period, let's call it the first half of March, we had three straight days where the S&P moved by 9%. That's really got no precedent, even in the financial crisis itself. The Treasury market started to buckle as margin calls were trying to be satisfied. is there a point where there's an evaluation of the kind of setup coming into this? As you noted, the exogenous shock is so significant that, of course, there's going to be a massive reaction in asset prices. But the reaction is also a function of the set of trades and characteristics of the liquidity going in. And this was quite a risk off. Is there some point in the future where we have to look back and start to do some reexamination of sort of how markets are supposed to function as we did post the financial crisis and perhaps implement some new regulations? Do you think that becomes a part of the dialogue?
I don't actually think that the conditions that led up to this represent a regulatory failure. I think there were some regulatory failures before the global financial crisis, but I think that more like the tech bubble, the conditions that preceded this episode were more excesses on the part of market participants, not regulatory failure. And those excesses were not as great as the ones that preceded the tech bubble. I think the market was high, prospective returns were low, leverage was high, credit standards were low, risky securities were being issued and bought, not horrifically, just to some extent. And it's important to remember, I think, that, as I said, this is not a typical cycle, certainly not one in which the correction was a direct effect of the excesses. I think that was the case in the tech bubble burst. Things just got so high and so precarious that the tech stocks, and then eventually it dragged down the economy, but the technology sector collapsed of its own weight. I don't think that was the case here. What we had here was a situation in which the operation of the market, the behavior of the participants, created a market environment which did not cause the collapse, but which created a vulnerability to an exogenous factor that could lead to a collapse. And then we had the arrival of the greatest negative exogenous factor in recent history, rivaled only by war, I would say, and by other pandemics. So I don't think this is analogous to the Great Depression in that regard, which was preceded by regulatory failure and exacerbated by governmental failure. This was a mildly precarious market that was vulnerable to an exogenous shock, which did arise. So what you would have to regulate would be the behavior of people. You'd have to stop them from being optimistic and from being eager to overlook the excesses and eager to put money to work regardless of the low prospective returns and weak structure and high leverage ratios. But if you wanted to regulate, I would be curious to know what one would do. Now, I'm one who believes in regulation. I'm not a libertarian. I just don't see improper behaviors. There might have been imprudent behavior, but you can't regulate prudence. I don't see improper behaviors leading up to this correction.
You've described yourself as a worrier, and one of your quotes that I particularly really like is, "All great investments begin in discomfort." And at least through some of your interviews recently and your writing, you did at some point start to look at the market and say, there's value here just because prices have sold off so dramatically. So it seems like that's what investing in discomfort is about. The timing seems to have been excellent, and we've recovered quite a bit in a very short period of time. How does one look at the kind of set of uncertainties now versus what asset prices offer in terms of value? How do you size that up at this point?
Well, I think that the period of the bargains that you mentioned was basically the stock market hit a high in terms of the S&P on February 19th, about almost 3,400. And then it sold off. And on probably the 20th of March, just a month later, it hit a low of around 2250. So it fell by more than a third in a month, which was a record decline. And the credit markets, where we're active, we're not active in the stock market, but the credit markets also dropped precariously over that period. And we were extremely active buyers of public liquid credit instruments in the two middle weeks of March. There was urgent selling, and on some of the days, what I would call panic. And we were able to put a good bit of money to work and get what we thought were great bargains in that period. Then on the 23rd, a Monday of March, the government announced that it would have an active program, which they disclosed the details later that week. And as you know, on March 24, 5, 6, we had 3 days, which produced the biggest gain in the S&P 500 in at least 80 years. And since then, we've had a further strong rise. And let's see, I guess that on the S&P, that was about 17.5% in those 3 days, and we've had about another 10% since March 26th, although the market has been quite flat for the last month. So obviously, it was the government actions that brought the market back, and what happened in the stock market was mirrored in the credit markets. And in short, I think credit, which was rather overpriced before, became cheap in mid-March and probably now, in some sense, is fair. Of course, we'd rather buy when it's cheap than when it's fair. We're not avid buyers today. Basically, what you have is a battle between the Fed programs and the economic weakness. And there's an old saying, don't fight the Fed. You can't fight the Fed. In other words, the Fed will win. And the Fed, with support from the Treasury, in the short run, in monetary and financial terms, can make just about anything happen that it wants. And the Fed wanted to bring back the level and function of the markets, and it has been successful in doing that. But the level and the function of the markets is, in some sense, disproportionate to the economic outlook, I think. I think the economic outlook is murky, and the levels of the stock and credit markets are so-so. They're fine. They're normal. So I see that as a mismatch. I think that the stock market and the parts of the credit market that have been affected are out of line with the economic outlook. But since we don't know for sure what the economic outlook is, I think we can't be categorical on that subject. So this is a note from one of our traders this morning, May 8th, and I think this puts it into perspective. The bears are saying we don't think the economy will open as smoothly as people think without a vaccine. This could take 5 to 10 years to rebound from. The bulls are saying the economy is reopening, deaths are slowing, we have made progress on a treatment, a vaccine could be close, the capital markets are open, and we have the full support of the federal government. So we have two positions which are diametrically opposite. The chasm between them is great, and in my personal opinion, we have no idea which is right. I think that the Fed is winning the battle in the market at the moment and has caused certainly many stocks and the liquid credit market to reflect the bull case, which I just read. And if the bull case turns out to be reality, then things are probably appropriate today. But I think that if the bear case turns out to be reality, the market is ahead of itself and will relapse. And as I said, I think there is absolutely no rational way to choose between the two.
So running with the Fed's interaction with the market and specifically with asset prices, another quote of yours, you say market crashes can't be predicted in the future, but the current price action and economic numbers can give you clues as it approaches. So I'm wondering, as the Fed perhaps necessarily has waded into risk markets in a way that it hadn't before, and maybe this is back to your days at the University of Chicago. I'm also a student from there. We were taught that the value of free markets is that price can serve as a really adequate signal. when you step back and look at the Fed's heavy hand, again, perhaps necessarily so, given the scope of the shock, should we be worried about the loss of price signaling as an input into the investment process? How do you kind of reconcile those things?
I'm not one who takes messages from the market in terms of telling me what lies ahead fundamentally or what is going to happen to security prices in the future. I don't think the market knows what's going to happen. I think the market prices just tell me what people think is going to happen. And then when I think they're wrong, I'm happy to bet against them. I think that market prices tell me today that people buy the omnipotence of the Fed. Thus, faith in the bull case is built into asset prices, and there is a possibility that they're wrong in that regard, and in that case, prices will turn out to be too high today, and buying today would be a mistake. If the bull case is correct, if the recovery goes pretty well, and America gradually goes back to work and GDP recovers, my feeling is that GDP will not get back to the 2019 levels until late 21 or 22 or something like that, probably at best, I would say, in which case the fact that the stock market is close to its 2019 highs, that is only, I think, 11% off, or maybe as we speak, only 10% off from the 2019 highs, that seems that people are optimistically signing on for the power of the Fed. There's not that much upside with the bull case. So I don't want to let the market tell me that things are going to do well. I let the market tell me only that people think things are going to go well. Having said that, we have a big bifurcation because the tech stocks and the industries that are going to benefit from the future environment have done quite well. And I note that as of yesterday, the NASDAQ got back to its year-end 2019 level. It isn't down, it's up on the year. While many cyclical industries and industries that have been and will be negatively affected by the crisis, such as hospitality and travel, is the greatest example, though they're still well down. So when we talk about the market being only down 11 or 10 today, it's an oversimplification.
Your comment on the NASDAQ is a fascinating one. I was saying if you took a nap on December 31st and just woke up, you'd have noticed basically nothing in your portfolio. As we finish up, and again, I want to thank you for helping our audience just further understand this just truly unprecedented time period. You've made a great contribution to the investment community through your memos over the years. And you've taken those memos as an opportunity to really survey the world of investing and just the big picture trends that you see. And a lot of what you talk about is trying to have some degree of second order thinking, to be contrarian. And maybe it's too early to tell, but I'm wondering, as you look at where we are right now, whether it's the result of cognitive biases or just common mistakes that investors make, are there things that you think might just be in the process of being misunderstood that 2-5 years later, we might look back on and say, wow, that was something that we just missed. There was a mispricing lying in plain sight. Are there candidates for that in terms of how you think things might evolve going forward?
Well, at this moment, I think the main thing to observe is that the things that have directly benefited from the Fed actions have recovered, and the things that have not directly benefited from the Fed's actions have not recovered. So, for example, I think public securities have recovered. Real estate, which has been negatively affected by the closures and, in some cases, non-payment of rent, probably has not recovered. And in the long run, in order to have an environment in which securities do well, we probably have to have an environment in which real estate does okay. So a big divergence of those two probably is not appropriate. And as I say, we'll see what the future brings.
Well, Howard, I want to thank you very much for taking an opportunity to share your views with us today. They're always insightful, and really thank you for your time today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Dean, and I've enjoyed responding to your interesting questions.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.